of the Wolf. Let me play a little bit of music for you. And I want to thank all of you for joining me today. And anyone want to say so long? Well, we can't. We're out of time. Come in, Jim. Get set up. I'm going to play a little bit of Amazing Grace for you because that's kind of how I'm feeling at the moment.
Of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin. The face of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin.
To see. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly radio program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning we start out with Dan Persson's review of Kubo and the Two Strings, and I'm going to have words about that. And we're going to discuss Hugo Awards, and I'm going to do what they call... Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persson's movie reviewer. I'm Dan Persson's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Is it fair for a critic to retcon his experience of a film after he's seen the film? I ask because I'm having a kind of a crisis of conscience with Kubo and the Two Strings. Not that I didn't like the film. In fact, I love the film. It's a great animated film. It's probably the best animated film this year. It may well be the best film this year. It's a gorgeously mounted stop-motion adventure of a young boy living in a medieval fantasy Japan who goes on a mystical journey to find his missing father's armor, the only way that he can protect himself from his grandfather, the Moon King, who wishes to steal Kubo's one remaining eye. Practically everything in the film captivates, from the way Kubo uses his shamisen, a three-stringed musical instrument, to coax life into origami figures, to the tender interaction between Kubo and his mother, who was traumatized into a semi-comatose state after rescuing her son from his grandfather, to the eerie manifestation of his aunts, who serve as the deadly minions of the Moon King, to the humor and depth of emotion between Kubo and his two traveling companions, the stern, sardonic monkey, voiced by Charlize Theron, and the addled but stalwart Beetle, a cursed ninja, voiced by Matthew McConaughey. And I respect director Travis Knight's willingness to incorporate a genuine sense of loss into the drama and not chicken out by cheating it back later on. This is the fourth film out of Oregon stop-motion studio Laika, who did Coraline and Paranorman, among others, and it may well be their best. But there was a problem I had, and I don't think it was a small problem. Came during the third act, when there are revelations about who Monkey and Beetle actually are, and how they impact Kubo and his adventures. And something didn't sit right about those revelations for me, about the way they were unveiled, and how the film handled the events subsequent. And this is again a time when I wish I could say to you, stop here and come back to this review after you've seen the film. But I don't think my host would appreciate that, so I'll have to settle for vagueness in my descriptions here. The upshot is that I was conflicted through the film's third act, still loving it, but concerned about a rather prominent, for me, flaw in the narrative. And it was after leaving the film, on the subway heading back home, that I had a thought. One of the running themes of Kubo and the Two Strings is that Kubo makes his living as a storyteller at his village's market, but a storyteller who can never finish his tales. He uses his shamisen to coax origami figures representing his father and various monsters into battle, but always bolts from the tale and the disappointed audience with a cursory to be continued. Kubo and the Two Strings is supposed to be about a boy finally writing the end to a story, his own story. When I was watching the film, my presumption was that it all took place in one reality, from beginning to end. But what if that wasn't the case? What if Kubo and his adventures with Monkey and Beetle took place in another, more mythic and fantastic reality, a storyteller's reality? There are visual cues in the film that might be suggestions of Kubo entering and leaving this reality, and looking at it that way, the third act revelations, functioning as elements of a storyteller weaving his tale before a rapt audience, work, at least for me. So I wasn't sure what to do here. It didn't seem fair just to ignore my experience in the watching of the film, and my after-the-fact reconciliation is admittedly a bit of a stretch, me working to clear away a prominent kink in a film I otherwise dearly love. And so I'm giving you both, and you can watch the film one way, and if that doesn't work for you, maybe you can try the other. Or come up with your own explanation. It's a free country. Because, at base, however you make your seeing of Kubo and the Two Strings work, you need to see this film, for its beautiful imagery, for its inventive action sequences, for its strangeness and its honesty of emotion. Kubo and the Two Strings, warts and all, is pure, flippin' fantastic. And just a reminder that The Scary Stuff lives on the Monster Channel, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can watch online and on your iOS device by going to monsterchannel.tv or on your Roku device by getting the Monster Channel app. And other devices are forthcoming. Stay tuned, so to speak. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
Yeah. You know, I have a wonderful little app on my browser which doesn't use the word Trump. Every time it sees the word Trump, what it does is it replaces it with the words "he who will not be named," or alternatively, it'll say Voldemort or Tom M. Riddle, or any of the number of names that are given the bad guy in the Harry Potter series. And it does my soul good not to see that blankety-blank person's name. I don't want to see that name. I don't want to know that name. I'm better for it. My life is better for it. So, and of course, as I recommend it to people, I noticed that it was taken down. Somebody removed it. Don't know why. Don't know why. So it's not a Chrome extension anymore. So what I recommend for you listeners is to get yourself a magic marker, and every time you're on your computer or your mobile device and you see a screen, you know, with a Sharpie, just cross out the name Trump. I know it's going to cost you a lot of money. You're going to have to buy a new monitor like every other week because you're going to see that a lot. But to not see that jerk's name is probably worth it. That's the mood I'm in, people. That's the mood I am in. But, and in case you can't tell, and you ought to be able to tell by now, this morning's is a freeform show. What does that mean? It means I don't know what the bleep I'm going to be doing. Actually, I do have a good idea. But I will start with telling you what the next four shows will be. And what the next reading of my reading series will be. And that's why I said before that I was going to Kvell. That's K-V-E-L-L in English. It's a Yiddish word, okay? It means boast. It means wallow in your own self-happiness. And so I'm going to do it. Why? Because, okay, well, one of the things we're going to do this morning is we're going to discuss the Hugo Awards. Now, I don't always do this. The Hugo Awards are a popularity award in science fiction. Note I don't say that it's always the quality award. There are several major awards in SF. One of them is the Nebula Awards, which is a peer award given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. They say of America, but they give it out to Asian people as well. They give it out, you know, a person in China, in fact, last year won, and this year won a Hugo. The Hugo is, then there's the World Fantasy Award, which is duh for fantasy, and there's a new award on the horizon that's being given out by Dragon Con called the Dragon Award. There you go. And the Hugo Awards are given out by people who attend the World Science Fiction Convention or are supporting members. In other words, you just pay your money, and then you can vote. And this is controversial because it has been gamed for the last couple of years. What they call alt-right wing, an alt-right wing group, has been trying to take over the Hugos. Last year, they succeeded in getting a lot of people on the ballot and thereby nullifying the awards. The result is that a lot of the categories, one of the things Hugo does, which I really like, is that you can you vote in place order, you know, what you like first, second, third, fourth. But one of them can also be no award. And so last year, many things won no award. But this year, there were a few things that they got in there. But the main four categories, which are novel, novella, novelette, and short story, were all legitimate. And what's more, because this was an alt-right-wing group, and they call those of us who don't like, you know, I like what some of these people call themselves, either the rabid puppies, who are rabid, or the sad puppies, who are saddening. I like the old stuff. I like to read Heinlein and all that stuff. A lot of that stuff is guilty pleasure. A lot of it is garbage. You know, L. Ron Hubbard, anybody and all that. But as a result of these people that don't like, you know, girls, people who aren't white writing science fiction, fantasy, and all that, they had a profound effect on the awards this year. Every award was won by a woman, two of them black. Okay, so there. The best novel, finally. I said last week on this show that my guest in 2 weeks would be N.K. Jemisin. And I said every single book that Nora Jemisin has written has been nominated for an award and has never won. But that will change. Well, the winner of the best novel was Nora Jemisin, and she will be my guest next week. Yay! Okay. So that's Kvelling, okay? I mean, Nora has been on this show many times. And it's going to be easier now because she actually lives in an unknown, totally classified portion of Brooklyn that isn't on any map that you look at. So, but we can spirit her here, and she will be here live. And if I can work it out, And we're going to experiment with this later this morning. We can take phone calls in a radio station without a phone. It's amazing what you can do. Perhaps. It may or may not work. Okay, so that's next week. The week after that is September 8th. And my guest will be John Ordover, who's been on the show a few times, although not in a couple of years. Why John Ordover on September 8th? Well, John was the editor at Pocketbooks for any number of years for a whole slew of books, 70 or so, based on some TV series called Star Trek, which began broadcasting in 1966 on, September 8th. So that'll be the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. So guess what the topic is going to be, people? Duh. On a science fiction fantasy show. Then, the following week, Rick Bowes will be the guest. It is close to the 15th anniversary of 9/11. And Rick, who's a regular guest and brilliant writer, and I've always thought he should be a person with a live radio show here himself, because he is so filled with knowledge and interesting opinion. But aside from that, he wrote a short story called There's a Hole in the City, which is a great story, a fabulous story. As Rick himself told me earlier today when we were on the phone, the story for which he will probably be best remembered. And when people think about fiction based on what occurred from 9/11, that is probably the best story. Ellen Datlow, whose name will come up again in a minute, Ellen Datlow says it might be the story by Lucius Shepard. Hey, they're both good. I like Rick's. She doesn't dislike Rick's. I don't dislike Lucius Shepard's. She likes Lucius's. But Rick will be here. And it's like an every five-year thing. He wrote the story about 5 years after 9/11. That's one of the things I like about it, is that it took a long perspective. It wasn't a lot of the really good things that were written in fiction and poetry were written in the heat of tragedy, in the heat of the moment, and people wondering WTF was going on. Rick waited 5 years and wrote just an amazing story that encompasses not only that New York tragedy, but also that of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the sinking of the General Slocum, tragedies in New York that cost hundreds or thousands of lives. And we will have that story broadcast. He was here for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. We were actually on the air at 11 a.m., and it was quite a thing, because at about 10 a.m., or 9 a.m., BAI just went off the air. Everything works here, right? Well, the transmitter didn't. There was a phone line problem. There was one thing or other. When I walked in to the station ready to do my live show with Rick, there in the control room were Catherine Davis, Tony Bates, our once and it would seem future program director, and Berthold Reimers trying desperately to see if we could get on the air. And we sort of knew, this wasn't going to happen. And we had to walk like a mile to get to the station because we were at 120 Wall Street, right near the site. We get here at 10:59. BAI came back on the air, and you were able to do the show. That was 5 years ago. So we did the 5th anniversary, the 10th anniversary, and we're going to do the 15th anniversary. Hope we're here for the 20th. Then 9/22, September 22nd, now these are all Thursday mornings. They're really Wednesday night, because let's face it, if you're awake now, You got up Wednesday, right? You didn't wake up Thursday. It's Wednesday, but we call it Thursday because in New York it's after midnight. Of course, if you're listening on the West Coast, it's still Wednesday. It's funny how that works. Time travel. Our guest will be Sonny Moraine, a brilliant horror writer. People who listen to me regularly know I don't love horror. I like a lot of classic horror that's, you know, ghost stories, things like that. I'm not into body horror, you know, where things happen to people's bodies. Oop, there goes another limb. Or splatter, or all of that stuff. It makes me queasy. I'm not judging what you should or shouldn't like. I'm telling you how I feel. But this woman writes incredible stuff, and I am very familiar with it because I am the editor, the audio editor of Nightmare Magazine. I am the editor, audio editor and host of Lightspeed Magazine. And its sister magazine is Nightmare, and I come across any number of her stories being performed for that, and I get to edit them. And whether I can deal with the horror of the stories or not, I got to wear my headphones and listen to them very carefully. So, and I met her a couple of times, and she and I did an interview at ReaderCon, but we agreed we would do a live show in September. Well, that's September 22nd. September 29th isn't totally set yet. Okay, let's roll back. 9-8, Star Trek Day, as it were. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, of which I am the curator and producer, will have a guest curator, Keith DeCandido. And downstairs in this building at 388 Atlantic Avenue, we will have any number of major writers of the Star Trek novels and short stories and things, including a special trilogy that is just coming out now. Three different writers, David Mack and Keith DeCandido and Greg Cox. Unfortunately, Greg won't be able to make it. And there is a woman at Tor.com who blogs about what they call a rewatch. They rewatch a series and then they write in-depth community kind of thing about that series. So she will be here. And then, as if by magic, using Skype video, Stephen Barnes will be joining us, a brilliant writer. But he's in L.A., and very possibly his wife, who's one of the great, great writers as well, Tanana Reeve-Dhu, may join him. She was the host of the Hugo Awards last year. They got her, and they got a gay guy, David Gerald, who wrote The Trouble with Tribbles. So there was a very star, and she wore like an Uhura uniform. She looks the part, let me tell you. So, so they will be here for that event. Admission is free. We will try to cajole you for a donation. But if you can't afford it, we expect to see you anyway. A fun time will be had, guaranteed. So that's September 8th, Thursday evening, 7 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue, ground floor at the Brooklyn Commons. Oh, and yes, I haven't finished the announcement. It's already 2 o'clock. I said I'd bring Ellen Datlow up. This is nothing I'm involved with. I just happened to see this on Facebook. The aforementioned Hugo Award-winning for Best Editor Short Form, Ellen Datlow, a frequent guest on this program, will be giving a talk tomorrow at Singularity and Company, which is a bookstore, or a bookstore because it's in Brooklyn. It's a bookstore in Brooklyn, and we'll be taking questions and stuff. And I don't have all of the information about it other than, you know, look up Singularity and Company online. You can search for it, and you can find out more about that event. And that is tomorrow. That is to say today, Thursday night. Okay, Dan. What was your stuff about Kudo and the two strings that you were holding back? First of all, I only saw one narrative. I will be seeing this movie again. And then I will be seeing it again. And then I'm going to buy the damned Blu-ray because I agree with you. It's one of the best movies of the year. Forget animated, not animated, science fiction, not science fiction, folk tale, which it is, although an original one, set in ancient Japan or not, with beautiful origami-based animation coming out of the Will Vinton tradition of claymation. The people at Leica Studios, I happen to read, were some of them were students of Will Vinton, who people – he didn't do a lot of movies, but while people certainly remember of Will Vinton, who created not stop motion, but he created claymation. So remember the singing raisins? I heard it through the grapevine. That's Will Vinton. And the M&M characters before they became computer generated and all that, that's Will Vinton. He also did a couple of short subjects and a movie. So the Leica people are sort of the next generation of that kind of stop motion animation. And they used origami, this being a Japanese style folktale, to tell a lot of the story. And it is a great original story. It's a sequel to nothing. It's totally original. How many movies this year can make that claim, huh? And then A Love and Friendship is another great movie this year, based on Lady Susan by Jane Austen, directed by Whit Stillman. It's almost more of a Whit Stillman movie than a Jane Austen film, but I like Whit Stillman movies. So those are, as far as I'm concerned so far, the best films of the year. Yeah, I enjoyed Captain America this year. That's fine. I enjoyed it. Was it a great movie? No, it was not. It was just a lot of fun. I'll see it again. I'll enjoy it again. Kubo and the Two Strings, great movie. Now, at some point, I'm going to have to ask Dan what it was. He said that the host of this program, that would be me, wouldn't want him to reveal whatever it was that he's talking about. Wrong, Dan! I'm perfectly okay. It's 1:30 to 2 in the morning. The people who shouldn't be revealed to are kitties. If they're awake now, they're on the other side of the globe. So, enough of that. I would like to get to discussing the Hugos briefly, but I want to see if we can take listener calls without having a phone here. And they have a Skype system, but I have no idea, neither did Kathy Davis, what the telephone number is for people to call in on Skype. I know it comes up on the computer here. I have the program running. So what I did was I bought myself a phone number on Skype, which is actually very cheap. It's about $6 a month. And I'm willing to give that number out to see if we can take phone calls. And somebody, please call me, especially if you have a comment about what I've been blathering on about. The telephone number here is for this show only, 718, area code 718-569-7737. Again, 718-569-7737. I want to see if this thing even rings, if it works, and if we can manage somehow to take calls on the air. Ooh, somebody's calling. Do you hear that? It's right on the air. Let's answer that. Hi there. You're on the radio.
Hey, Jim. I think it works.
Oh, I guess it works. Wonderful.
Hey. I haven't called in a long time. There's been a lot of disasters going on.
Yeah, well, yeah, they haven't stopped yet, but
Well, yeah, it's like Bop Apocalypse or something like that. But
yeah, right.
Can I make some comments on movies that I've seen?
And please
get off the phone really quick and let somebody else call in.
Sure.
Because you were talking about movies last time. I think I agree with Entertainment Weekly's annual review,
which I haven't seen. Tell me about
best. The best. You know, this is what I think is the best, and they put on their best, is It Follows. Really incredible.
I've heard really good things about it. I haven't seen it.
It's probably the best thing I've seen in a long time, and I haven't liked anything since, like, Dark City, which I rave about.
Yeah, you got me to see Dark City. I really liked it. If not for you, I wouldn't have seen it.
Here's the next one that nobody talks about. Plus One. Have you heard about that one?
No, it's there's a new Android phone called that, but no.
And it's probably hard to get because it's a hard title. It's not like the word plus, it's like the symbol plus and then
okay.
One.
Right.
So that's what it is. And the premise is that there's some sort of anomaly over this house and it's like too much decorations or something and it's like this huge rave party and somehow it creates like this time, you know, timey-wimey thing. And it's like there are doppelgangers everywhere. And everyone has like weird reactions to it. And what do you do when you see yourself like twice and three times in different stages of the night and thousands of possibilities? You know, it's like all this kind of stuff. And it's like, I won't even tell you, a guy's trying to initiate a three-way and it turns out to what at the end. And it's like it's really weird, and I think that's
yeah.
The best
I was reading something
that's not on the entertainment list. I'm sorry. The worst
but it's on your
one,
list. Okay.
And I have to warn you.
Yeah.
Is Vice? It's probably the worst movie I've ever seen. Not to mention the worst science fiction movie I've ever seen. And the premise.
The title again.
Vice.
Oh, Vice. Yes.
Yeah, and it's with. Miscast Bruce Willis as the arch villain and Tom Jane. What am I, Tom Jane from Arrested Development, if you don't know that line?
Yeah.
Did you watch Arrested Development?
I about three episodes.
So it has Tom Jane. Now, how many scenes have you seen? How many times have you seen like this kind of stuff before? I mean, it's like the captain yelling at the rogue cop not to mess with the corporation behind this wall.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
This is where all the rich people play, and they play with like this kind of Westworld scenario with androids, and they could like have everything that they ever conceive of, and everything illegal, and every vice, so to speak. But they never show you what it is. It's always behind the wall, like, you know, in Star Trek when they go to the bathroom. You know, it's like it never happens.
Right.
It's like somewhere behind this wall, no one's allowed in it. And then he's chasing this other woman, may or may not be an android, as of Blade Runner. And all she's doing is like running down these corridors, getting shot at 1,000 times, not getting hit, and like dodging amongst lots of smoke. You know, it's like, what's going on? It's probably the worst movie, and it goes on like that. There's probably 20 scenes of just her running, and Bruce Willis trying to be an arch villain, and he looks like he's just sitting there drinking cappuccino behind a chair.
Poor Bruce Willis is a
Bruce
fine
Willis
talent
is
who's
not
done a
villain.
Lot of crappy films.
I still like Hudson Hawk. It's like one of the golden turkeys.
You know, I did not hate that movie.
The other golden turkey since Thanksgiving is coming up. No one has ever seen. I mentioned it before on these. I don't know how. It's called Certain Fury, and it's the worst movie. It's like a buddy picture about like fugitives, and the fugitives are Coco from Fame and Tatum O'Neal. And they're like on the run, and it's like Peter Fonda's in it, and it's like really Canadian.
You always manage to come up with these movies.
Never will come out. Oh, that one was directed, and I think someone yelled at me because I was mentioning Jake Gyllenhaal, right?
Yeah.
And she thought I said Jake Gyllenhaal directed the picture and would have made him like 18 or something. Or I don't know how old Jake Gyllenhaal is now, but it was Jake Gyllenhaal's father. Directed that picture.
Oh, really? So, okay.
Yeah. And it's like a real hoot if you ever see it. Actually, I got a book that kind of goes, takes apart all these like kind of bad movies we love situations, a la, you know, Mystery Science Theater, but it's like you don't even need Mystery Science Theater, and it says it has a whole chapter just on Patrick Swayze, poor guy, Sharon Stone, all the movies of Sharon Stone, all the movies of Patrick Swayze and stuff like that. But anyway, It Follows, I have to recommend, because it's actually a monster movie. And think about it, Jim. How many monster movies come out?
Well, actually, you know, that's a question for Dan Persons, who's on the Monster Channel.
Mm.
I mean, this year, I haven't seen it, but I assume that Cloverfield 10 has something to do with monsters.
Did you know that there's 10 leprechauns?
Yes.
Can you believe that?
Yes.
How do they, you know, you were, I just trying to allude.
And
why?
And
not only how are these movies made,
the only
why are they made,
thing I can
Sharknado
say
and all this stuff. They should just make trailers and let us be amused by the trailers.
I'm glad that what's his name, Willow, I'm blanking on his name, is making a living. That's all.
Yeah. And of course, the ultimate nerd show is Game of Thrones, which I just got into.
It doesn't
make any sense when you start watching it, because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does if you follow it from the beginning. I read the first book. I watched about the first 8 or 9 episodes a little bit before they killed Sean Bean. But the thing is that it's, gratuitously gory.
And gratuitously sexy. That's the only thing. That's the only reason I have HBO.
And
cursing.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
R-rated stuff, the kind of stuff that the generation hence.
There's
R-rated movies for.
There is some fine television out there right now, and a lot of it is streaming. I know that a lot of people, it's become vogue to love this show called Stranger Things, but I've got to tell you, it's excellent.
I heard good things.
It's really, really good. It's sort of like a Weird Tales thing. I love the form of, like 6 to 8 episodes and then move on. Thank you.
So they're not doing that. Like continuity or is it an allegory?
It's continuity.
Oh, so
and
it's
simply
continuing
it's
characters.
It depends. It depends. I mean, for example, Fargo, the TV version, which is, only very, very loosely associated with the movie. What connects it? Well, the area in which it occurs. They all have that accent. And number two, the suitcase.
I think what Orson Welles used to call the MacGuffin.
It is the MacGuffin.
MacGuffin is
only that comes from Hitchcock, not
Orson Welles. It's literally a suitcase. You don't know what's inside of it.
Well, in this
Nobody
case, we know there's a lot of money in there.
Same thing in Repo Man, and the same thing in Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction, that's right. But no, that's a different suitcase.
No, but I think
Touch
of Evil too has a suitcase in it.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that's the same suitcase as in the other movies. And yes, Orson Welles said it was the MacGuffin, but it's a term coined by Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
Wells simply used it from Hitchcock. But this is a different suitcase because in the movie Fargo, the lead character fills a suitcase with money as ransom that he expects to get back.
Was that a character actually created by the Coen brothers or was it pre-created before that movie?
No, it was created by the Coens.
And okay, so that character is not in the movie.
None of the characters from the movie are in the either season of the TV.
Certainly not Steve Buscemi.
Right. The
okay.
nor Bill Macy.
Can I ask a trivia question because it's driving me crazy?
But I just wanted to say the thing that ties the two seasons of Fargo together plus the movie, there's only one thing that ties them together. That suitcase, it appears in all three.
Mm. So, Jim, how many Lemmy Caution movies are there?
Oh,
besides Alphaville.
Outside of Alphaville, I don't know. I believe there are others.
I think within my scramblings, I preserved at least two Lemmy Cautions and one Eddie Constantine movie called, anyone can find it, it's brilliant, SOS Pacific, and it has Eva Montes, it has, I don't know, a whole British cast and stuff, a really great cast. It's kind of like Casablanca. And then it turns into Survivor or something.
Oh,
and then one called
like
Poison Ivy, one called Not Now, Darling. There's another one called something Fury in it or something. Not Certain Fury, something else. But I was wondering if there are any more.
Dan Persons would probably be the person to ask, and he'll probably hear this and let us know, and I can mention it next week if it's not taking away time from Nora.
Fascinating.
But
okay, so I'll mention some Doctor Who stuff, and then I'll get off the phone.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, Rick and Morty. The first Rick and Morty season, I don't know about the second. Oh, it was really funny, I have to say.
Okay.
I mean, I was mentioning that to a guy who never watched Red Dwarf either, which is another...
There's a new season of Red Dwarf coming up, by the way.
Oh, great. That's a show that grows on you. I
but
mean,
the last
really
season
funny.
Wasn't that good, where they come back to Earth.
They were kind of like...
it started
let's put
well,
it this
the
way,
first
long in the
tooth.
I mean, how many seasons? Is it 12 seasons? 14 seasons?
This will be the 11th.
Well, I mean, how many years have gone on in between each season?
Oh,
so they have ages, is what I'm saying. It's like,
but that's
wrong for any show.
Well, that's not unusual. I mean, Absolutely Fabulous did the same thing. And that's not unusual. And that's not a problem except for, well, Holly, of course.
But the young ones kind of evolved into a comic strip, into something else.
I think I saw Saunders
on Blandings. That was really good. But,
yeah, but the last... series of Red Dwarf, which was four episodes long. The first one was like, oh, they're back, it's fun. And then the last three episodes, all of which go, you know, occur back on Earth, were bleh.
Yeah. I think one guy died, right?
I'm not sure.
That's what I heard. Yeah, it's like the two guys that created it, I think one guy actually
Oh,
died.
that may very... Yes, I believe you're correct.
Yeah, so it's like that might have been where the extra...
I think Naylor is still with us.
Yeah. I forget who's who.
Yeah.
But I guess nobody has said... Let me caution, if people don't know, predates Bond, and if you've ever seen the movie Alphaville, I guess in the continuity, that's the last Lemmy Caution movie.
It is. As far as I know.
And it's also a very good Godard movie, and it used to play at the Thalia, where I used to work.
Hey, they played it at Film Forum.
Godard heads are in there. And,
oh, you were at the Thalia, were you?
I was at almost everywhere.
Oh, okay.
In the theater.
Well,
I could tell you Fawlty Towers stories about the guy that owned the Thalia, and he passed, and was literally strangling people, you know, in front of customers. And I'm going, oh, yes, may I help you? Like, you know, he's like Fawlty Towers.
We had a person at BAI who was the candy concessions person at the Elgin.
I go way back. I remember, I mean, I actually said this, and because, you know, I grew up on the Lower East Side, so I'm walking on Avenue B and saying to somebody casually, and this is like a long time ago, but this is even a farther time ago. I said, I remember going to see a picture at the Elgin East, right?
Ooh.
And there was an old guy on the corner who overheard me turn around and he says, damn, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. I saw The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight there, which I think was actually filmed half a block away from the movie theater in the movie theater.
Some of it was filmed in my neighborhood in Jackson Heights.
I'm sorry?
Some of it was filmed in Jackson Heights.
But there was a scene where something exploded
like
on 14th Street, which was a half a block from the theater at the time I was watching it.
Yeah.
Let me mention a couple other things, and then we have to get off. Splinters is the other one. Another monster movie I'd recommend if you could find it. And what did I see? There were so many good things I saw. There's another science fiction one, and it's kind of like missing me now. I saw a lot of good horror, though.
Yeah, I'm not a big horror fan, although
this is really good. It was called
The
Hellion.
One that I want to see that
I gotta
haven't
recommend
gotten
it.
Around
it's a horror
to
movie, and it was like if Terrence Malick directed a horror movie,
uh-huh,
it would look like this.
Right.
So, I mean,
have you seen The Babadook?
It's called Hellion. I usually don't like, you know, this is a little bit more arty, and it has like these like kind of shots where, you know, the sun's shining through the lens, and it's just, you know, the autumn, you know, it's very, very done, whatchamacallit, artistically or something. So.
Yeah. Did you see The Babadook?
You know, not all the way through. And I have problems with the theory of it and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
I didn't get to the very end. It had some sort of scary elements to it.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
To tell you the truth, I was, as a kid, the kind of stuff I was scared of as a kid, I mean, let's get real, Stephen King, it's a lot more scarier, you know? And if you think about it, everybody's childhood is a lot more scarier than this kind of stuff. And usual children's books are pretty scary as well.
Well, I mean, yeah, you take Roald Dahl and that kind of stuff. That's
Alice
pretty
in
scary
Wonderland,
stuff.
Wizard of Oz.
Disney. Bambi.
Well, Disney, I could recommend a really weird
Pink
video.
Pink Elephants
that
on Parade on from Pinocchio. That's also
Did you hear someone mention this to me, Jim?
What?
And I thought it was hokum. And then it was pointed out to me, like I'm an idiot on a video, that in the signature Disney, and next time you see it, I'm sure you see it everywhere, that there is 666 in the signature, twice. And they showed it, like in the I and the D and the, everything.
I have
like,
heard
it sounds
that.
Like a ridiculous
I've
like, conspiracy
heard
theory, but
that,
sometimes
that,
you look at it and
photoshopped
go, what?
In when they demonstrate it. Yeah.
I heard in, well, so many reasons to hate Disney. What's the other thing I hate
not,
the most?
Not nowadays. I mean,
well, they listen.
Many
they acquired
of the best
Marvel
movies
and DC,
today are
all
Disney.
The things I like: Marvel, DC, Peanuts, and Oz, and I think the Smurfs too, right?
Well, no, those aren't all, only one of those is Disney.
I think.
But into the woods.
And the Muppets. Muppets too.
The Muppets
so it's like
are
it's
Disney.
Almost everything that ever existed that was ever good and fun. And I think it's weird because it's like, you know, Marvel and DC, they're going to start making these movies and maybe they'll make some decent animation.
Well, DC
but they'll be so watered down and well, and I don't like what they're doing with Marvel anyway. It's just a complete.
I actually enjoyed a great deal. But I have to, you know, there have been some hits and misses. But, you know, The Avengers, written and directed by Joss Whedon, is one of the best of its kind.
I had problems with it.
Okay.
I mean, foremost being like desperately to be jokey and not very funny.
Well, I didn't think it was desperate. And
you can either be one or the other,
it was
but
quite
not
funny.
Both. Well, I like when Marvel in the original 60s series didn't take itself so seriously and the characters actually.
Well, see, there and that is the point is that Joss Whedon didn't take it seriously either. He decided to have fun. You know, in the beginning when
what would a John Whale done with the Avengers?
James Whale, perhaps.
Yeah, that guy. He had a theory about stuff, too.
He wouldn't have known from it. But listen, we need to move on.
Very good.
Okay, thanks. Good to hear your voice. Take care. Okay. Ooh, and there's that weird Skype sound. Okay, well, that was interesting. And you know what? We'll take more calls. I'm so glad that it worked. What I did, Lister, was I bought a Skype phone number so that people can call me on the air. And I gave it out, and it worked. It's $6 a month. Yeah, we can do that. I've already paid for it. But, I mean, you know, not to worry. And I don't mind if you use the number because I'm not going to use it for anything personal. So we can talk about that. Not this week, but after this week, because I have to figure a couple of things out with it. But I thought I was going to talk about the Hugo Awards, and I haven't gotten around to that. But I'm not going to do all of the awards. I just have commentaries to make. And there is a major, major topic about the Hugos that I have avoided for over a year. And I just, aside from making reference, and I talked about it a little earlier, there are these two organizations. The first one calls itself the Sad Puppies. The Sad Puppies would recommend science fiction that they like. They're sad because science fiction is no longer what they want. It's not based on science. It's very often poetic. It's being written by these people that don't look like what most of these white middle-class people look like, and so forth. So now all they really did is they said, Here are books that we recommend, and you might want to vote for them for the Hugo. It wasn't that bad. And, you know, there are other people, including those on the other side who are now called SJWs for social justice warriors. And they say that like it's a put down. Well, I'm a freaking SJW. All right. Because, yeah, I believe in social justice and I will be a warrior for it. So there. Now, they're not so bad because the sad puppies are just that sad. And a lot of the things, by the way, people are making huge things within the community and with outside of it. I mean, this has been written up in the New York Times. This has really made its way around. And when you take a look at the sad puppies and, you know, something that recommended, how many people recommended this book? Two people. So, you know, everybody sort of like chill. The sad puppies are just that. They're sad. Not a big deal. But the rabid puppies are another story. There is this guy by the name of Theodore Beale, B-E-A-L-E, who now calls himself Vox Day, V-O-X Day. I have no idea what that's about. I don't give a bleep. He tried to run for president of Science Fiction Writers of America and instead got himself, through things that he said, got himself banned from the organization. And since then, what he started his own publishing company based in Finland, okay? Not making this up, Castilia Press. And he started putting together a slate, like a political slate. You vote for these things. First thing is you nominate these things. And last year, especially in the shorter categories like short story and novelette and novella and best, his people who took his slate totally dominated the things. Now, how's this possible? There were only like 20 votes. Not that many people get involved in the nomination process for the Hugo Awards. 20 people can take over a category. And if one person tells those 20 how to vote, and that person has, you know, whatever power, and, you know, one writer, for example, got 6 nominations. And it's really, really, well, they're rabid, but they're sad. And they ruined the Hugos, and there was a lot of, will the Hugos ever come back? Because if anybody can just buy a vote, and this, by the way, a little bit of history that people don't recall, in a way it almost happened once before, because what happened was that Scientology, which is, of course, people forget, an organization based on the musings, what is the word, the manipulations of a science fiction writer. It made its debut in Astounding Tales. I never get the full name right. Barry Molesberg will write me and tell me, no doubt. But it made its debut in Astounding under the name Dianetics. L. Ron Hubbard wrote it. Of course, L. Ron Hubbard is a major science fiction writer. Between him and Heinlein and a couple of other people, they would often use pseudonyms so that you might have an entire issue just of Heinlein with Anson MacDonald and his pseudonyms, and Hubbard with his pseudonym Rene Lafayette and stuff. And maybe Campbell would write something in there. He wrote a short story called Who Goes There, which was made into a movie called The Thing. Which is actually, you know, it's The Thing. You know, it's been made twice. Anyway, Hubbard. Oh, so Scientology has its roots coming out of science fiction, which is something I was very disappointed in, a rather good book about Scientology called, It's by Lawrence Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. Getting Clear, Going Clear. It's about clear. And then Alex Gibney made a movie out of it. But it totally misses and skips the business about how it comes out of the science fiction community. There is lip service saying, Hubbard, bounce around the science fiction, feel free. Well, I have a theory I'm not going to get into now, how the entire premise of Scientology came not only out of science fiction, but in fact, I think that Hubbard was trying to place himself as an Isaac Asimov character, Harry Seldon, to be precise. And that's a whole rant I've got that comes on another time. And my proof for it is non-existent. It's just a theory that is mine. But when I tell it to people, they go, ooh, that's actually rather interesting. And yes, it is. Anyway, so now the Scientology action has this thing called the Writers of the Future contest, and they sponsor it, and people win awards and stuff like that. And you know what? It turns out it's actually rather good. They really have done a lot to foster good writers, have nothing to do with the so-called church, nothing to do with Scientology. They're people who have been judges and teachers and all that of Writers for the Future, good people like Tim Powers, A.E. Van Vogt, who was a Scientologist, but he was also a great science fiction writer, and he wouldn't let that get in the way. These were people who helped do that. But some publicist at the time, Bridge Publications, is a big thing in Dianetics, you know, the bridge to the stars, right? It's now Galaxy Press. I hate them using that name because Galaxy Magazine was a great science fiction magazine. This has nothing to do with that magazine, but they bought and own the title Galaxy Press anyway. Scientology tried to buy the Hugos. They had their writers who were winners of Writers of the Future, and through no fault of the teachers, no fault of the writers, people within the Scientology organization bought a whole bunch of memberships, and they were caught because they were all using consecutive check numbers. Yes. It was like $25 to vote, right? So this. So he got like, 10 or 20 checks with consecutive numbers. The Hugo committee, they just didn't cash the checks or anything. But the rabbit puppies, this is a different thing, is they post there, you will vote for these people. And they're very, well, he who shall not be named like. That's Trump, very like that. And they ruined the ballots last year. Not even coming up with old classics or stuff like that, but with what, in my considered opinion, is rubbish. It wasn't good stuff. And none of it won. Because what ended up happening was that, as I mentioned earlier, people get to vote for no award. And if they had totally taken over a category, people voted no award. This year, more people voted for the Hugos than ever, for the nominating process than ever before. And wonderful people won. There were a couple of problems in there, and I'll run down the – I'll mention a lot of the nominees because, you know what? The people who were nominated and didn't win are very often still just top-notch. So there it is. Now, let's see.
Let's hear the list.
Okay. I'm trying to find it is the problem.
Tell me, why more people voted this time than the last?
Oh, because as a result of the way that it was gamed.
Oh, okay.
They wanted to make sure that here's the list. They wanted to make sure that they would do it differently. So the nominees for Best Novel. The awards were given out last Saturday night, by the way, in Kansas City. I'm very upset I didn't go. I was at the first WorldCon that was held in Kansas City in 1976, where Heinlein was guest of honor. I did a very brief interview with him. There was some guy named George Lucas who was showing previews of a movie that he was calling Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I don't know what ever happened to that film. And I got to eat at the best barbecue I've ever had. Arthur Bryant's, so good because Calvin Trillin, so good that because Calvin Trillin has written about it in the New Yorker and has a book called American Fried, which is just fabulous. Anyway, I wanted to go this year, I couldn't go. The nominees for Best Novel were The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. She's been on this show. You've met her, Lister. Yes, Nora. Yes, you know Nora. Yes, yes. Uprooted by Naomi Novik. Naomi hasn't been on the show for a few years, but she has been here usually to promote her Temeraire novels, and they're very good. Ancillary Mercy by Anne Leckie, and she's won frequently for her other ancillary books. Mm-hmm. They are good, but they're not quite my thing. That's just a personal thing. Oh, by the way, there were this time 2,900 ballots, approximately. In the past, there have been like 300 or 400. Mm-hmm. This year, 2,900 as a result of all this. Seven Eves, a novel by Neal Stephenson, a fine, fine writer of hard science fiction with interesting social statements. And The Cinder Spires, the Aeronaut's Windlass by Jim Butcher. He's a good tongue-in-cheek writer. So these are all legitimate people. Number one! What? Nora has now, as of last week, published 6 books. Because the new one, The Obelisk Gate, just came out. And so she hasn't had a chance to be nominated for that because it's only been out for a week.
So she's not in the list?
No, her previous book, The Fifth Season, was on the list. Okay. But so she's written 5 novels and a few short stories. And she's been nominated, including the short stories, about 7 times and never won an award. Until last Saturday! Everybody, next week, Nora will be our guest.
Oh, great.
Everybody join in and go, yay!
All right.
She was going to be our guest, win or lose, but she won. She bleeping won. She won! Okay. Can you tell that I'm pleased that she won? Yes. And it's a great book, by the way, The Fifth Season. Uh-huh. Okay, novella, which has fewer words than a novel. Oh, okay, I see what I did here. Right, novella. Binti by Nnedi Okorafor. She is a Nigerian-American. Mm-hmm. A wonderful writer, by the way. Penric's Demon by Lois McMaster Bujo, whose writing I've liked. It's very addictive, just fun stuff. Slow Bullets by Alastair Reynolds. Good writer of hard science fiction, a lot of fun. Perfect State by Brandon Sanderson. He's been on this program. It's a page flipper. Yeah. You'll enjoy reading it. It's a page flipper. And The Builders by Daniel Polansky, who I'm sorry to say I don't really know his work, but it's from Tor.com, uh-huh. So you can go online to Tor, Tor.com, and read it. And Nnedi Okorafor won. Binti. Okay, so, novelette, yet shorter. Longer than a short story, shorter than a novella. Folding Beijing. Oh, God, I don't want to do it.
Why?
Because it's an Asian name. In American transliteration, it's H-A-O.
Just spell it, yeah.
J-I... N-G, F-A-N-G. I'm going to guess it's along the line of Hao Jinfeng. Hao Jinfeng. It would be something like that, translated by our friend who has been on the program, Ken Liu. Now that's L-I-U, and I've always said Ken Liu, and Ken says, yeah, that's the American pronunciation of my name. It's actually Liu, and I'm missing a little something in there. So sometimes it's just safer to stick to the American version because it's wrong to mangle. I'd rather do it American style than mangle it in its proper form. And You Shall Know Her by The Trail of Dead by Brooke Bolander from Lightspeed Magazine. As I was editing the audio version of that novella, novelette rather, I was saying this is a bleeping great story. I love that story. It hadn't been published yet, and I was calling it out. I said, this is going to go places. And Brooke has been on this program. She lives in Brooklyn. She's read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction. So yay for that nomination.
Great.
Obits by Stephen King. You've heard of Stephen King. What Price Humanity by David Van Dyke. That's an angry puppy thing. What Price Humanity? That's from a book called There Will Be War, Volume X, from Castalia House. That's this Vox Days Press. And Flashpoint Titan by Chia Kai Y. There's a pseudonym there. And that's also Castalia Press. So in that case, the two Castalia Presses, no award won above. And the winner was Folding Beijing by Hao Jingfeng. So,
that's good.
Best Short Stories, Cat Pictures Please by Naomi Kritzer from Clark's World Magazine. And then, well, these aren't all... Well, mostly. Then Space Raptor Butt Invasion by Chuck Tingle from Amazon Digital Services. This is a rabid puppy pushback story is what it is. Asymmetrical Warfare by S.R. Algernon from Nature Magazine, which I can't comment on one way or the other. I doubt that's a puppy story because it's a Nature magazine. Seven Kill Tiger by Charles Shao from that same Castalia House anthology, There Will Be War. And so in other words, a puppy. And then If You Were an Award, My Love by John Tabo and S. Harris from voxday.blogspot.com. It's, you know, just this guy's freaking blog is no validity. And guess what? Only one story there was even taken seriously in terms of votes, and that was the one from Clark's World Magazine by Naomi Kritzer. So, what we have are the four main fiction awards: novel, novelette, novella, and short story. Number one, thanks to these right-wing, don't want girls writing science fiction, don't need people of other cultures, that includes black people writing science fiction, every winner was a woman, number one. Great. This is, you know, the rabid puppies have really improved the genre. They have, because look at the pushback. The SJWs are winning, great. Jerks.
Great.
Okay? Number two, of those four, two are black. I won't say African-American because... Well, what am I saying? Nnedi is a Nigerian-American, so yeah, African-American.
So you can say black.
Oh, except that I'm not sure that she isn't African. Well, yeah, she's black, but so I'm not sure black. That she isn't African-British as opposed to African-American.
Black is an internationalist term, so you can say
she's black.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Nora's black.
Yeah.
Hao Jingfeng is not. He's Chinese.
No.
Ken Liu is considered Chinese American.
He's considered black too.
He's what we call a person of color.
Okay, outside the United States, he's considered black because it's an international term.
Now, this is something I'm unaware of.
Oh, yeah. Only in the United States, it's different. Just like the pronunciation of his name is different, the American way of pronunciation.
Well, not only. I mean, in other countries, you know, there's a British pronunciation versus the American pronunciation. Right. They would do it differently than we would.
Yeah, but black is an internationalist term, and it in it covers
I know that, for example, an Indian person in South Africa in the apartheid time was black,
Yeah, well, Chinese people are considered B-L-A-C-K and so on and so forth.
I did not realize that. I did not realize that. Well, he's Chinese, so there.
Okay.
And Naomi Kritzer, I don't know what she looks like. The name of the book is Cat Pictures, Please. So maybe she's a cat.
Well, you can say she's black, because if she's white, she's from Africa, therefore she's black.
Well, I don't know. No, I don't know where Naomi Kritzer is from.
Okay, she's black.
Oh, if you say so, what she is she's a good writer.
She's a very good writer, yeah.
And all the other people, no, there were some good people who lost, but the whole point is that the puppies lost big time. They were shut out. In the one category, best related work, which means books about science fiction, every single thing in that category were from the rabid puppies, and no award is what won, which was the best of the nominees. It was no award. Best graphic story, by the way, was The Sandman Overture, written by Neil Gaiman, art by J.H. Williams, and the rest, no award. Best dramatic presentation, long form. Okay. This now is real stuff, real nominee, real movies, good stuff, a tough category. The Martian, Mad Max Fury Road, Star Wars, The Force Awakens, Ex Machina, which is a brilliant, thought-provoking movie, and Avengers Age of Ultron. Now, by the way, when you vote, you get to vote your number one choice, your number two, three, four, and they run it through.
Right.
I voted Mad Max because I thought this. Have you seen Mad Max Fury Road?
A little bit. Yeah, promos.
No, forget promos. It tells you nothing.
No, I haven't seen.
That tells you nothing. This is a socially relevant, very important. It's the fact that it's an action flick.
Oh.
It has nothing to do with anything. This is a very political movie. Good movie.
I'll go see it.
I think you should. I think you should. The Martian won, largely because it is hard science fiction, good cast, all that. It just wasn't my favorite. That's all. I liked it. It was a good movie. I liked it. I liked Star Wars. It was certainly better than the last three Star Wars films that George Lucas put out. For that matter, it was better than...
Clever director, right? The director is very smart, right?
J.J. Abrams, but he's overexposed and all that. Ex Machina, now that's an original movie written and directed by Alex Garland. Very provocative, very thoughtful, interesting film. You can't talk about it too much without giving lots away. There's three people in the entire film and keeps you riveted. And Avengers Age of Ultron, written and directed by Joss Whedon. I love Joss Whedon. I enjoy the Avengers movies. I enjoy the Marvels movies. This is just not a great film. And it came in last. They went in the order that I read them: The Martian, Mad Max, Star Wars, Ex Machina, which I would have put much higher. My choice was Mad Max, Ex Machina, Star Wars, The Martian, and Avengers. That was my ranking, my personal ranking. But good stuff won. Okay, best dramatic presentation, short form. That means like a TV show or something. Jessica Jones, Doctor Who, Heaven Sent, Grimm, Headache, no award, then Supernatural, Just My Imagination, and get this, My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. Now, what I dislike about this category in general is that you're not voting for a series. You're voting for an episode. And that makes it difficult. But Jessica Jones won, and Jessica Jones is very very, very different form of Marvel comic entertainment, and the TV version is harrowing and feminist and brilliant. So I'm glad that it won. I prefer as a series Doctor Who, but not that episode, Heaven Sent. But I'm glad Jessica Jones won. I'm very glad. Best editor, short form, Ellen Datlow, Sheila Williams, Neil Clark, John Joseph Adams. No award, and Jerry Pournelle. So Datlow, you've met her, a friend of ours here at Hour of the Wolf, won.
Great.
Long form, Sheila Gilbert, Liz Gorinsky, no award, Tony Weisskopf, Jim Mintz, and the horrible Vox Day. I feel bad for Tony Weisskopf and Jim Mintz. Bane books, which are very supported by the sad puppies as opposed to the rabbit puppies, they turn out good books. They turn out a lot of good fiction. Mm-hmm. They do turn out some military science fiction and stuff like that, but people have equated them with the right wing, and they're wrong to do that. They're just wrong. I'm not saying that they necessarily should have won, but I am saying that they deserve to be above no award, not beneath it. Mm-hmm. But Sheila Gilbert and Liz Gorinsky were the first two, and yay. And then we get into artist and semi-prozine and fanzine, File 771 for fanzine. I'm being interviewed for File 770, so that's neat. Best fan writer, Mike Lyer. Best fan artist, Steve Stiles, old friend of mine. And the John Campbell Award for Best New Writer. This is not a Hugo. This is a different kind of a thing. Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, and Alyssa Wong, who will be with us in November.
Great. How comes your name is not on the list?
Because I'm not a writer.
Okay.
There's that little thing. Although my work with Lightspeed Magazine, Best Semi-Prozine, we won the last 2 years. Good. But now we're no longer a semi-prozine. Now we're a professional magazine. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a prozine category. It's weird. It's really weird. And that's the problem with fan awards.
Can I interject? Speaking about science fiction, they've discovered a new planet that's almost similar.
That's
like
right.
Earth. Well, they're light years away or something.
Well,
like
no, it's a lot more than two light years.
Four light years then.
About 4.5 light years
that's
away.
That's a couple of generations, right?
More than that. More than that.
Wow.
Well, we can't travel at the speed of light.
I know, but we can travel per generation.
Perhaps generational ships, as developed by Robert Heinlein, and stuff like that. It's a thought. It's a way of getting to a place far, far away. But then there's a lot of other ways to possibly create interstellar travel, which include like the folding.
Warping is
imagine that this sheet of paper. Everybody on your radio, take a look. This sheet of paper, and we are over here on the right edge, and our planet X that we're trying to get to in the Betelgeuse galaxy is on the left hand. Mm-hmm. What you do is you take using things like dark matter and things that we don't fully understand yet, we take that paper and we fold
it
so that one is next to the other.
Excellent.
And what do we call it when we do that? We're warping it.
That's great.
That's where the Star Trek idea of warp speed came from. This is an idea that's been around for years and years. Asimov always used to write it. Now, this is the stuff of science fiction.
It's like sex. Warpiers.
There you go. Right. But an important factor here is simply that
we're getting closer.
I know. An important factor is that there's so much we don't know. We still don't know how people can stay in space for any period of time and not lose all the calcium in their body.
Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah.
People that like go to the ISS space station for a couple of years. Russians frequently spend as much as a couple of years there.
Yeah.
Once I'm trying to find my drive here. Blah, blah, blah. Ah, there we are. They come back and their bones are brittle. Their bones are very brittle. And they stand, and they don't have their balance. It takes at least a couple of years, sometimes, for the people who've been away for a couple of years to reacclimate. And some of them never fully recover from that. So there's a lot about space travel and all that that, you know, we just don't begin to know. And it stays in the realm of science fiction. Yeah. And but that's the fun of it, because science fiction gives us goals to look for. Well, we don't have time to discuss the retro Hugos. I suggest you look them up, because a lot of great science fiction was published, well, 50 years ago. And so what they, so that 1941, that's not 50 years ago. Well, how, this year they gave out the Hugo Awards from before the Hugos existed. And this year was 1941. And the best novel was Slan by A.E. Van Vogt. Heinlein, and Asimov were the winners. And this is as it should be. Even if the puppies think that too, so do I. But these were real writers. These weren't these jerks. So what can I say? Apparently not a great deal. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We will be back next week with Hugo Award-winning Nora K. Jemisin, N.K. Jemisin, discussing her new novel and probably reading from it, The Obelisk Gate. It's about time she won. We're so pleased. So I'll be on at 1:30 with Nora next week. I hope that you tune in. Join us on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group. Free to join and all that good stuff. And don't forget, September 8th here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek will be celebrated. So stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way very shortly. And everybody, please, please be good to each other. Good morning.
spirit. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am.
You know, the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works. Jerk, my people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. But no black for the brother, and I'm no lover of this flag. Like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. A nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm messy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest. And watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
So head to my shoulders, and I'm a waist, and I'm a knees and toes.
Feel the burn.
From my pants to my belt to my shirt, and in every stitch of my clothes.
Feel the burn.
Tertiary education, advancing the nation, healthcare in affordable dose.
Feel the burn.
Consistently fighting for the people for decades, everybody knows it.
Bernie and a realist,
50 states and every territory can. From my pants to my belt to my shirt and in every stitch of my clothes.
Feel the burn.
Tertiary education, advancing the nation, healthcare in affordable dose.
Feel the burn.
Consistently fighting for the people for decades, everybody knows it.
Poverty is ingrained in the fabric of society like a religion.
That has got to end. Millions of working people who are working hard but are not making enough money to put bread on the table or to take care of their kids, and that has got to end.
You never see another one of me.
Shatter the star, don't die until the last reel. Mama used to tell me there'd be days like these. Bone smugglers come out in twos and threes. Many little youth will grow, don't know. Excuse me, thanks and please. Babylon pressure the king stop. Dragon a breeding a neck back, oh. Hey, hey, Babylon a van in a pay spot. King when I take that, no. There's a hole in the pumpkin, see it there. Politician come straight, come clear. No bother with the hype thing, cause we compare from year to year. Takes more than a lot of ugly pagan to make me scare. Them think I'm on the ground, but I'm in a me there. When they over here, hey, you can go and climb on your broken chair. Babylon a pressure the king's top.
I know, I know, Dragon a braid in a neck back, boy. Hey, hey, Babylon a van in a pay spot.
I know.
No king when I take that, no. Pressure me one.